I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude, about human creativity in this case and the teaching of it with men who've taught each other. John Maeda, whom I talk with whenever I can, is the computer smart designer who's been shaking up the Rhode Island School of Design for a year now as RISD president. Sir Ken Robinson is the wisecracking school reformer that John Maeda invited to give the RISD commencement speech this spring. I asked them both to an open source conversation at 7:30 on graduation morning. I was wondering, among other things, what might happen when two of the great stars of the TED conference speech, that very modern form of delivering ideas worth spreading on the web, what if they could talk back to each other, which they never do at TED? But I also knew that there was a personal connection here. Ken Robinson's TED Talk 3 years ago about living out your passion rang like a gong in John Maeda's head. It was a signal, Maeda said, that he had to change his life, and he did. Out of the MIT Media Lab and the engineering of technology into the RISD world of teaching art and innovation. So this was our three-way conversation last Saturday morning at the Hope Club in Providence, Rhode Island, about expressiveness and originality in art and life across the board. Ken Robinson, John Maeda, over breakfast before a momentous occasion of the RISD graduation, what does the creativity guru want to say to kids who've already chosen a life in art, an expressive life for themselves?
Well, don't trust gurus would be, I think, one of the first things. I remember someone saying to me years ago that artist is a gift word. It's not a word you can give yourself. Mm. It's a word that other people give you if they feel there's something about the work you do. And I think that's true, and I'd hope the students would remember that, that you can't self-consciously produce art. It's art is an achievement rather than, I think, than a plan. Mm. I think the same thing is true of being a guru. I've never described myself that way, but I keep hearing that thing. I think the other thing I'd want to say, and I'm going to say to them, is that, you know, imagination really is all we've got. Right? Imagination is the fundamental human capacity. And many of us spend a lot of time having it suppressed or suppressing it in ourselves. Mm. And the work of the creative spirit is to celebrate it and to cultivate it. And it's important work, not just for the individual, but for all of us.
If I woke up this morning and said, Chris, you've got to fight to assert the imaginative possibility in your life today, where do we begin?
Well, I think the first thing for me is to recognize how characteristic it is of human beings. It seems to me the great enterprise of all creative processes is to challenge the things that we take for granted. You know, the great enemy of creativity and innovation is common sense. You know, the things that gather around us as being obvious, the things that we just think are naturally true and have always been this way and will always be that way. And really, prime among the things that we take for granted are our own capacities. You know, we take it for granted that we have imaginations, that we can conceive of alternatives. And yet this is absolutely unique and distinctive to human beings. I mean, other species may have the kind of glimmerings of imagination, but you don't see the evidence of it in anything like the same degree. The great quantum leap of humanity is to bring to mind things that aren't present, to conceive of alternatives and possibilities. And insofar as we're concerned with humanity and our role in preserving ourselves and all the other species that increasingly depend on us, I think we have to not take for granted the one distinguishing feature that our intelligence gives us. And I believe we have to exercise it and nourish it and feed it. You know, if you were aiming to win the Olympics in the 100 metres, you wouldn't lie around on a sofa for the next 4 years and then turn up and hope it would happen. You know, optimistically thinking, well, I'll see how this plays out on the day. You know, you'd do something about it. You would nourish it, you'd exercise it. And I think anyone who's interested in the creative adventure of humanity has to challenge the things they take for granted, including the things about themselves that make them distinctive, and feed and nourish their imaginations. And my big concern is that education, you might suppose, is one of the processes that would help us do that. And I think increasingly it does the opposite. I think most education systems almost systematically stifle imagination and create conditions which are hostile to creative thinking. So I was thrilled to be at somewhere like RISD, and especially RISD, because its whole work is to do the opposite. It's to encourage freedom of thought and creative possibilities and the depth of individual talent.
John Maeda, you've anticipated this day for a long time. What do those kids need to hear or want to hear? What are they ready to hear?
Now, this is like a great day because I remember sitting in the audience at TED, you know, watching Sir Ken speak and realizing, oh, wow, this is exactly what I was thinking. And it kind of, you really helped to change my life. I think that's when I decided to just change my career switch, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because he was talking about how the greater challenge of academia isn't the academic system itself. It's what creativity might be able to do in the world, and how different structures had to be invented or even like played with somehow. So it was just shortly after that, you know, I got a call from RISD and I thought, oh, this is a grand challenge. And so it's sort of very special that he's here. It's especially special because, you know, coming from MIT, which is a pretty intense place, to RISD, which is a differently intense place, I've just spent this year trying to understand how this whole thing works. And, you know, everything that Sir Ken said in the introduction is just sort of maps quite perfectly. You know, your comment on the Olympics, you know, how you can't sit on the sofa and wait to get more creative. RISD is known for people who can work at superhuman levels. I have photographs of people at every time of day, like lying on the floor, like exhausted, because they're just so passionate about their work. And so what happens is people think creativity is like an easy thing. It's like, I'm going to go paint and take a break. It's going to be so great. I'm just going to like let myself go and like be creative. But at RISD, creativity is an arduous journey. It's a serious endeavor. It's a risk your life to do something interesting. So that's what I see here.
There's a lot of you in this story, I sense, that, I mean, coming out of computers and engineering into your own design head and your own expressive self, do I read it as part of the John Maeda story?
I think it's just a story of someone trying to, like Sir Ken here is saying, the great enemy of creativity is common sense, to break common sense somehow. And that's hard because as you age, you get quote-unquote smarter. And you get all the patterns that make sure you won't like die by accident or make a big mistake in public. And so common sense is all those rules that hold you together as an adult. And I think I've been fortunate to just continually ask the question, well, what if you could keep that spirit alive as a professor, a designer, or artist, or maybe even as a college president?
Hmm. What's your theory, either of you, as to where it begins? I'm thinking of Amanda Palmer, a very hot singer with the Dresden Dolls. And she tells my grandchild, make art every day. She tells everybody, make art every day. I also think of Joseph Beuys, the German artist, who really believed every man is an artist, every woman too. But the question is, where does it start?
Well, I think it's helpful to start with a definition. And John's right, you know, there are all kinds of misconceptions about the creative process. You know, people think it's just sitting around waiting for inspiration to hit you. It's about special gifts. It's about luck. Some people have it, some people don't. It's unfairly distributed. And I think all this is nonsense, you know, that firstly, that everybody has tremendous natural creative capacities, everybody. It's an endowment of being a human being, that you're born with them. The truth is, though, that some people discover their real creative possibilities and others don't. And that's partly because of how we educate people. The second big misconception is that it's about special things, you know, that there are only certain activities which are inherently creative. Mm. And that's equally mythical. You know, you can be creative at anything, absolutely anything, that involves your intelligence. I mean, I put together a large-scale strategy for the British government about 10 years ago. And I know that the government thought, when they asked me to do this, that I was going to get a commission together exclusively of artists. Well, you know, the arts can be tremendously creative, but so can science, and so can mathematics, and so can business, and so can broadcasting, and so can anything. So one of my campaigning issues for a long time has been to get creativity out of the ghetto and to get the arts integrated with a bigger argument. And the third misconception is there's not much you can do about it. You know, you're creative or you're not, and that's the end of it, and good luck with it. And what RISD testifies to, and all great institutions like this, is that you can create conditions under which creative capabilities will grow and flourish, that you can teach some of the essential processes of creative achievement, that it takes application and work and controlled materials and discipline. So my definition, I remember some politicians in Britain saying, the problem is you can't define creativity. And I said, no, I think the problem is you can't define it. You know, so let me define it for you. So my definition is the process of having original ideas that have value. And all three bits of that to me are important. Firstly, it's a process. It's not an event. I mean, it occasionally happens that some idea hits you fully formed and that's the end of it. But much more often, an idea may stare itself in your mind and it's the beginning of something, not the end of it. You then have to work on it and evolve it. And often doing that is a very material business. You know, you're working with physical materials. It could be steel or clay, or it could be words or numbers. It could be a conceptual process. It always is, to some degree, a conceptual process. But it's a process. It's very rarely the case, I think, that what comes out at the far end is what you began with. I remember Elliot Eisner saying, I thought he put it really well, he said that art is a surprise, not a prediction. And it's partly because of the way this process unfolds, but it's as true of science as it would be of the visual arts or of music or theatre. The second thing is it's about originality. It's thinking new thoughts and trying to make something fresh and original. And that's a real job of work for all the reasons we're saying, because our minds quickly become kind of enthralled in assumptions that we don't question anymore. And the third thing is it's about critical judgment. It's about value. And I think this is a really important part of the conversation, because not any original idea is any good. Some original ideas are actually just not worth even pursuing. They're original, but they're kind of worthless. Now, I say that knowing that, you know, the next question would be, well, who judges the value? And the question is, partly you do, as you're doing it. I mean, everybody I know who works in creative work, in any process, in arts or sciences, has had false starts and said, well, that's not it, I'm not going that way. That's your judgment, that isn't the right way to take this anymore. But then often, you know, mature works are produced and the culture as a whole thinks this is a waste of time. And that's because there's a difference of value being applied to it. And my point is just to say that, is that every creative process isn't just about thinking fresh things. It's acting critically on the ideas. It's a kind of reciprocal process of hypothesizing and of critique.
Walk into a school system, rich or poor, in England, in the States, city, rural. I'm sure you do it all the time. And when the teacher asks you, show me the approach that opens a different possibility, where do you begin?
Well, I think this is crucial because, you know, there are teaching or pedagogy is really at the heart of this. You know, when governments get around to thinking about education, as they sort of consistently do now, they tend to focus on only two pieces of education. And there are really three, actually four. But the first is the curriculum, which is what it is that people are meant to learn. And the argument for a more creative approach to education has profound implications for the nature and structure of the curriculum. So I always say to head teachers, look at the foundations of the curriculum. What are you setting out that people are meant to engage with and to learn about? And there are all kinds of things embedded in the traditional approaches to curricula which are obstructive. Like there's a hierarchy of subjects. Like there are subjects. You know, I'm not very keen on the idea of subjects. The second thing that policymakers tend to focus on is assessment. And invariably, they rush to start to introduce standardised testing. You know, they believe you can't raise standards without standardising. And actually, if we know anything, standardising doesn't eventually lead to the highest standards. It leads normally to the lowest common denominator when it's applied in a broad way across the whole of an education system. So I think it has a big implication for assessment. I mean, for example, you can't encourage creativity in any discipline if the whole ethos of assessment is there's a single correct answer, you just need to find out what it is. You have to engage people in open areas of inquiry. You have to give them open questions. You have to give them challenges which will stimulate them to find a new way of conceiving of either a way to a solution or even if the problem's the right problem to think about. But, so the heart of that is pedagogy. You know, the heart of really good teaching is always, of good education, is great teaching. And places like RISD exemplify that. You know, the things that people remember at RISD are the great teachers they work with. And great teachers know that there's a way of opening you up to new possibilities while supporting you in your inquiry. And a lot of teachers, I think, or too many, think that teaching is just telling you stuff they know already. You know, and that if you're locked into that model of education, that you know, the process of education is just to tell you things that are known, and then to assess whether you've absorbed them properly, then immediately you start to stifle the whole creative impulse.
John, can you explain the process at RISD of pushing the against the impulse to copy or to repeat or reproduce?
Well, I'm kind of like a, you know, by coming from, you know, the Media Lab, where it was all new technologies to do something brand new, and it was always like that was the value, is something new. Here at RISD, every step of the way, it's always been about teaching. It's the intellectual property at RISD is how we teach. And the only thing I ask all the time is this modes of inquiry. So we're teaching modes of inquiry that work to create creativity. And the question is, in this new era, are there new modes of inquiry, like both Sir Ken and I Twitter? And we talked about it last night. And it's a different mode of communicating. It's sort of like the old one, but kind of brand new. It's like the old one in that you can access minds, but like the new one, a random person in some random city in some random place can talk to Sir Ken Robinson or myself, and we might respond. Which is brand new, and for free.
One of the things I'm going to talk to the students a bit about today is the need to connect rather than make distinctions. I mean, distinctions are important, but it's as important to see connections and to see relationships. And I think this is especially true when we talk about process of creativity. When you said, how do you encourage them not to copy? I think we should encourage them to copy. You know, I don't think that copying is bad, or that every idea they come up with has to be unique to mankind or humanity. The process of sort of mastering your craft, of being in control of your discipline, is essential to creative work. You know, it's why John is right to point out your expertise in what you're doing. You know, that it isn't that it has to be constant freeform. You know, you can't really be a creative musician if you can't play the instrument. You can't be a creative mathematician if you can't do the math, you know. The whole trick about pedagogy, though, is to recognise this sort of symbiotic relationship between developing your imaginative capabilities and your control of the materials that you're working with. And a lot of traditional teaching, I find this a lot interesting in music schools, focus on learning the discipline before you're allowed to think about anything. You know, so people spend hours and hours and hours and weeks and years practicing doing scales with no encouragement to apply it to ideas they might find interesting. It's all about repetition. I mean, it's true of all music schools. Ballet is often like that. I was on the board of the Royal Ballet. And, you know, for a lot of kids, ballet training is just a ruthless repetition. And you wouldn't, I think, want to describe it as creative. Because a lot of the because there's no room for it very often. So I'm saying the real creative process to me is an interesting amalgam of, you know, of learning models and styles and studying other people and what they've done, learning from great practitioners and other practitioners too, and mastering the craft, but seeing it as a constantly interrelated process then of exploring your own possibilities. And I think if we had, I know that's not really what you're suggesting, but it's an important discussion point, that if creativity is presented as a remorseless process of novelty, you know, and of, you know, it doesn't count if somebody else thought of it, then it just very quickly starts to dissipate. You know, I think people have to recognise that our own creativity is endlessly fed and nourished by other people's ideas. You know, that it's a collaborative process and it's a cross-cultural process.
Here's the payoff question. It's not about politics, but it is about this Obama moment, the age of Obama. I sense a tremendous curiosity among artists, too, and writers and musicians. How do we meet the challenge of a man who has changed the atmosphere, opened up so many different possibilities that we didn't really believe were at hand? Do you know what I'm talking about,
yes.
Ken? The Obama challenge.
I loved Obama's inaugural address. I was very interested that in the run-up to it, you know, all the pundits were saying, well, will it be as good as Kennedy and will it go anywhere near Roosevelt's? And I don't know why we have to keep making these comparisons, but and afterwards somebody saying, well, it wasn't quite like Kennedy's. You know. And I think, stop. I mean, you know, where were the great phrases? I thought it was full of them. You know, I just thought that it was so measured and sensitive and tuned to the moment. Because what he was saying, you know, was, you know, we are facing, you know, a time of the most extraordinary challenge on every front. And we cannot do this as a government ourselves. You have to do this, you know, you, the people. And our job will be to create a climate and hopefully create conditions and opportunities, but you need to take them.
He's creating the climate, it seems to me, a little bit more every day.
I really think so. And it's in such sharp contrast to the previous administration, whose motif was, you just keep your head down and we'll sort this out for you. You know, you're in peril, so don't make a wrong move. You know?
John, what is the invitation, shall we say, to artistic spirits?
There's an opening. There's an obvious opening in terms of, like, we need creativity. But there's an inobvious opening, which is to talk about creativity in a new way. That's more interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. Artists and what they can do is so unique. What does that mean? Give it a reason. Give it a name. The best example I have is I met a lawyer, a RISD grad, intellectual property lawyer. And she tells a story of how she went to RISD painting. She took some years off and then came back to school and thought, well, I'll go to law school. And her first year in law school, she was just, you know, already was studying and everything. And a couple of faculty pulled her aside and asked her what school she went to. And she said, well, why do you want to know? She said, well, we have to know. And she said, well, I went to the Rhode Island School of Design. And they sort of like, what? How's that possible? And she said, why do you want to know? And they said, because law school is a very difficult, arduous thing where we take your brain out, we squish and make it into a lawyer. It's trauma for most people. I mean, they just can't make it. He said that you have no problems whatsoever. Why is that? She said, well, I'm an artist. I've been taught to critically think, take apart my thinking, squish it around, make it new. It's very normal to me. So that's a story that has to be told more often.
Interesting. Last word.
I think that artists need to be sure they're part of the solution there. And that means, I think, opening their own minds to new thoughts and possibilities.
Yes.
You know, one of the areas that we've taken for granted for too long is that the arts and sciences are totally discrete and alien territories to each other. And a lot of the people I know who work in the sciences are hugely creative. They're passionate about the arts, and the processes they use are very similar. I was talking a while ago to a friend of mine, Harry Kroto, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. He's also a professional designer. And I asked him what the differences were in the creative processes in arts and science, in the studio and the laboratory. He said, there's absolutely no difference at all. It's exactly the same process. I mean, the outcome is different, but the process is the same. You're dealing from things you know, you're hypothesizing, you're testing ideas, you're pushing at the borders of your own imaginative range. And he said it's exactly the same process. And I think what I'd want people to recognize just now, in this new age, if we can make it happen, is that these divisions between arts and sciences and technology are relatively recent too. If you go back to the Renaissance, people didn't see these distinctions at all. Mm. And I think it's really interesting and significant that John has moved from MIT to RISD seamlessly, because his creative processes work equally well in both settings, and you know, design is at the heart of both, and so is inquiry.
Sir Ken Robinson, a joy to meet you. John Maeda, always a pleasure to riff. Let's do it again. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with John Maeda of the Rhode Island School of Design and Sir Ken Robinson. Create your own response, please, and consider yourself invited to post it on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.